Blog Talk Radio.
This song probably been done about a million times, but it ain't never been done like mine. We're talking about a million Africans. We're talking about 10 million Africans. We're talking about 100 million Africans.
The African Holocaust,
we're talking about the genocide that went down in Rwanda. We're talking about Darfur. We're talking about Sierra Leone. We're talking about a million diamonds. We're talking about the Congo, B. We're talking about a million of our people in prison. We're talking about a million of our people dead, unemployed, homeless, hungry, B. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans. 100 million Africans.
1 million Africans. 2 million Africans. 10 million Africans. 100 million Africans.
They say we ain't got no right to complain. I just laugh at them. You can have the whips and the chains. I don't hate on them, but hopefully they gonna catch up. I ain't gonna wait on them. Kanye, Lupe, Pharrell, I will skate on them. 1 million black men locked up in prison.
Oh, damn.
Think I'm kidding what it is, but I isn't. And if you didn't know, it's just cause you ignorant. Cause pigs lock up motherfuckers just cause of their pigment. That is racial profiling. No, I'm not wildin'. Y'all sucking dialing.
Yeah, it's about
them smiling. 1 million people was here before they even came. And ever since they came, they just changed the game. They brought a few million more and then they changed our names. That turn the devil burner, come to burn your shit to flame.
We gon' burn it down, baby.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back. Cracker, tell me that it don't matter, but matter of fact, I'm the surprise in the box, I will crack a jack. After that ain't nothing else to do but to holler black. 1 million kids who ain't got no options, either they down with the goons or the goblins. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Drop them off here and now you is a Haitian. Drop you off here and now you is Jamaican. 1 million, 10 million, let's bring it back, man. Yes, they are the devil. What's the devil to a
black man?
Nathan, nothing. They ain't saying nothing. We don't need another old white man. Finger on the button, cause the last white man had that type of power. Had 6 million people taking gasoline showers. The Bible told me this world is ours. The meek shall inherit, but that don't mean to be cowards. One stupid white man can knock down 2 towers. Y'all niggas got it backwards. Y'all niggas got it backwards. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Wampanoag, 1 million Blackfeet, 1 million Navajo, 1 million Apache, 1 million Iroquois, 1 million Sioux. You done killed about 1 billion people, man. Even two would take a nation of millions, hold us back, I thought you knew. And everywhere they go, this is just how they do. Was 11 million Africans living around Soweto. 1 million white folks had them in the ghetto. The ghetto, the ghetto. You all love the ghetto. You talk about it so much, but we ain't seen no bread though.
Breaking more.
I take 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Build a couple hundred schools, hit you for 4 million more. 1 million Haitians, refugees know the score. Cause you don't want 1 million motherfuckers at the door, man. I am Farrakhan in 1 million man marching. Approach me with caution, 1 million people watching. I do this so often, 1 million places on this earth, but I come from Boston. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Africans, 3 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
Harriet Tubman came too. We got a long legacy, this is how we do it. Uno the prophet, Nat Turner, devil burner. 1 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans passed through that transatlantic slave trade, the African Holocaust. Don't forget.
Yes, welcome to another edition of Your World News, a special Thanksgiving Day, otherwise known as Thanksgiving Day special we have today. We're going to break down the origins of this vile celebration of European massacre upon indigenous people in what's now known as America, but what the indigenous people refer to as Turtle Island. We're going to be discussing that in depth today. We're going to be discussing the connections, because some people may say, why would you talk about, you know, the past in such depth and this, that, and the other, all these issues that are going on. Well, the celebration of days like Columbus Day and Thanksgiving Day, in its essence, I mean, we can turn the TV on and you'll see the parades, you'll see people going to the parades and having little fixtures in their houses of these settlers and the mythological outfits that they were supposed to wear, the buckled shoes and the long brimmed black hats, you know, which were, you know, actually creations, later creations, to kind of dress up and to even further glorify these vile invaders. But just the fact that there's this celebration of these individuals, you know, such as William Bradford and John Winthrop and on, and the actions that were taken out on Wampanoag and Pequot indigenous people to justify a day of giving thanks for newly plundered land that has blood all over it. It is, in essence, it explains to us how, you know what I'm saying, how a nation can continue to create mass injustices, not just within its borders, but outside of its borders, in places like Pakistan and Iraq and Afghanistan, and we see the U.S.'s continued presence, you know, unwanted military presence and corporate presence in places like Haiti. So we're going to discuss the intersectionalities, how they connect from one to next. And as you may or may not know, I'm Solomon, and I'm the host of Your World News. The co-host, Peter Fowler, will be on in a few seconds, a few moments. He's joining us from parts unknown. But this is where you can find, on Your World News, you can find critical analysis and dialogue of current events, issues, topics that you simply will not find on the corporate media, but you will find on alternative progressive media in different pockets throughout the U.S. You know, there are people that are doing similar things throughout the U.S. and doing it far better than we. And we've been inspired by the likes of Black Agenda Report and the good work that Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon and the rest of their staff have been doing for years. And so this is our contribution to the struggle, to the revolution. So without further ado, I want to introduce, have Pete come on and say a couple words, and then we will hit the ground running. And that artist that was just playing, that was Uno the Prophet out of Boston, and I thought that was an apropos song to play to kick off this show, because throughout this song, I mean, he you know, discusses some real important issues that we're African. People brown and black skin, we're Africans. Matter of fact, everybody is African since the cradle of civilization started in none other than Africa. But in terms of those that have brown and black pigment to our skin, beautiful brown and black pigment to our skin, we are nothing but Africans. We're not African Americans. We are Africans residing in America. We are American-born Africans. If you were born in America, we are Africans. You know, we didn't just because the boat, when the boat left, you know, the many, many boats that came, you know, that stole masses of Africans, millions and tens of millions of Africans, and brought them here just simply because they came to what is now known as Haiti or Jamaica, as Uno the Prophet was beautifully sketching out with his words. They didn't just mysteriously lose their Africanness. They are still Africans. All right, they were renamed, just like some folks were renamed, you know, John Smith or, you know, Bill O'Neill, or, you know what I'm saying, William Jones. You know, these are not African names. These were European names that were imposed upon their ancestors and then handed down and down and down, and that's why many of us have the names that we do. Those are not our real African names. Those are names that were forced and imposed upon us, much like Christianity, much like these damn holidays that seemingly far too many of us don't know the roots. We just don't know the half. But And so systematically we continue to embrace these holidays without knowing its history. And it's not saying, and I'll end on this, it's not saying that you cannot spend this day to spend with your family and use it as an opportunity to spend with your family or to build with your community or loved ones, all right? But if you continue to celebrate this holiday without knowing its origins, without having dialogue with those loved ones about its origins, all right, that is a very, very dangerous thing, and that is the continuation of the mass propaganda and indoctrination that is working so perfectly. And so there must be dialogue. You know, I choose to use this day as a day to give back to the community in some shape, form, or fashion, whether it's going to the local juvenile detention center, as I will be doing later today, and spending some time with the brothers there, or, you know, some of us may go to a homeless shelter. But these are things that we can do throughout the year as well. We, you know, they don't just have to happen on Thanksgiving or other days. They can and should be happening throughout the year. So, you know, just those are sometimes some of the things that we need to think about. I know many of us are doing those things, but we need to really push that those seeds of activism to folks near and dear to us. So, Peter, can you welcome yourself to welcome the viewers, the listeners to the show, to who you are, and you know, a couple of thoughts on this day before we actually get into the nitty-gritty about this day, the historical backdrop and other things regarding Thanksgiving.
Good morning, Solomon. Can you hear me just fine? Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Fine. Loud and clear.
All right. As always, it's good to be on the air with you, brother. And, you know, it's so appropriate that we're taking the time on this fabrication of a holiday to explore its roots, to explore its origins. And I'm so glad that you went in the direction of talking about what you do as alternatives and mentioning some of the things that people can do as alternatives, because it's one thing for us to talk about the negative side of this Thanksgiving holiday and to talk about its barbaric history and the actual cultural effrontery that it comprises. But it's another thing then to say, well, what do we do instead? Or what do we do with this knowledge? What do we do with this information? I think that's really important. And I hope that we can talk about that today, too, in terms of breaking down or deconstructing what this Thanksgiving holiday is. And then also, after that, say, okay, now that we have this knowledge, now that we're equipped with the knowledge and the information and the facts and the truth, what then do we do with it? Instead of just going about business as usual, once we're equipped with the power of knowledge, then it's incumbent upon those of us that have the knowledge and the facts and the reality to do something with it, to do something different. So I want to be able to get into some of those possibilities and that dialogue about what we should do instead, and also look at what some people are doing instead, because there's other people around the country that have tapped into this long, long, long before we have, and are actually doing things today to demonstrate their resistance and their opposition. So I guess that's what I'm getting at is, one, We need to deconstruct the fabrication that's known as Thanksgiving, the fabricated history that you alluded to earlier with the cute little pilgrims that we made out of construction paper when we were in grade school and so forth around this time of year. Deconstruct that actual holiday, and then let's talk about some opposition to that, because we need to have the oppositional theory before we can have any kind of oppositional activity or oppositional organization. So today is probably one of the best days of the year to talk about the narrative of America and the fabrications that go into that. And I'm going to end my comments, these initial comments, by quoting from Glenn Ford, in a piece that he published a couple of years ago, and he republishes every year, I think, And it's something that's one of those pieces that we need to read every year at this time, and we need to think long and hard about these timeless words of Glenn Ford. But he talks about Thanksgiving in these terms. He calls it an affront to civilization, an affront to civilization. And then the other thing he says that is so powerful and that we need to highlight and talk about why, you know, some people might think, well, why are y'all making such a big deal about it? Well, because, as Glenn Ford says, the Pilgrim Enterprise that got kind of consolidated down into what we call Thanksgiving today, he calls it Act One of the American Dream. All right? In other words, it set the table not only historically but also ideologically for the rest of the conquering of the continent by the European invaders, not pilgrims, not settlers, but invaders. It was Act One. It set the table for that. So I think with that in mind, we can move forward, do some deconstruction, offer some alternatives, and hopefully help our listeners make some sense out of what Thanksgiving is, what it is not, and then what folks can do with once they're armed with some new knowledge. So let's do it, bro.
Right. And so I think what would be good is for us to give folks a historical context, and many of the folks listening may already have that, but and that, you know, please feel free. There's so much history, historical backdrop in terms of this whole so-called holiday in and of itself. So if there's something that someone wants to mention that we don't mention, you know, please feel free to call in if you have a question or comment. You know, our number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. This is community radio, so it's your radio show just as much as it's ours. So, you know, we value you know, your comments and questions, so long as you respect the microphone. So to start off, let's look at, you know, what really happened in Plymouth, you know, going back to 1620, 1621. You know, first of all, let's get this set at the so-called first, you know, field harvest that occurred. There was no turkey, there was no pumpkin pie, there was no cranberry sauce. You know, it was most likely it was venison and geese and those types of things. And the venison, the deer, were actually brought by the indigenous Americans, the so-called Indians, Wampanoags. And when we look at an indigenous man by the name of Massasoit, who was invited by the pilgrims to this feast. And while engaging in tribal tradition of equal sharing, he invited, you know, 90 of his Indian brothers and sisters. That ticked off a lot of the ungrateful, barbarian Europeans that were there. And if I use Horace Slate, the reason I'm referred, as Peter and I get into this story, and you this accurate, true story that of what occurred and what these folks did in terms of how they massacred, in terms of cutting heads off and kicking heads down the road and putting heads on poles to make a point, and quartering people, cutting their arms and their legs off, cutting their hands off, burning women and children and elderly to a crisp. That's why I refer to them as barbarians. All right, that is why I refer to them as barbarians. You do actions like that, you deserve not to be called anything else but barbarians. You don't deserve to be celebrated in any shape, form, or fashion. But these are the folks that because these Europeans came and they were wildly unprepared for what they were about to embark upon in the so-called New World, the so-called New World where people had been living there at least 10,000 years prior. But if it wasn't for the indigenous folks, the Wampanoag, the Pequot, Squamagans, you know what I'm saying? If it wasn't for them teaching these folks how to plant their maize, how to harvest it, how to stay warm in the these brutal Massachusetts, these brutal New England winters. They would have died off far sooner, and so these ungrateful folks, were upset that Massasoit invited his brothers and sisters there, despite the fact that he brought venison and other food to the field harvest. So as the real quickly, I'm going to say a couple more things and let Peter pick up on the story, and we'll just kind of go back and forth through this. The reason I said in the beginning that there were no black hats or buckled shoes, these were basically like just ridiculous inventions of the mind of artists that, like, hundreds of years later, want to dress up, and make these folks into something that they weren't, something that they're not. And so, there wasn't these, like, buckled shoes that you see, or the hat that you see folks dressing up as, in the back of parade processions and so forth. They were in a lot of ways were very primitive. they were very primitive. And then there was a character by the name of, and I say character, a real individual by the name of William Bradford. And this is one of the most vile human beings ever to step foot on the face of the earth, as well as John Winthrop, and we'll get into them later. But William Bradford became the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And, he's one of the folks that, just to kind of give you a backdrop, these are folks that they would drink at least a half a gallon of beer a day. They preferred drinking a half a gallon of beer per day more than they did water. They preferred that even to water. Not one of them, but many of them. And so, Peter, I don't know if you want to go on, because this is going to get deep. But Peter, I don't know if you want to chime in.
Yeah, I do. Just a couple things as you were talking, because there's so much information as this story unfolds, and as you tell the factual elements of the story, bits and pieces of it jump out to me. For clarification, you mentioned Plymouth, the area in it's now Massachusetts, in which the folks that are referred to as Pilgrims landed, and the rock they call Plymouth Rock, hopefully most of us are familiar with the line from Malcolm X where he says, with tremendous rhetorical and metaphorical power, he says, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. And that's an apt metaphor. But why is it called Plymouth Rock? I mean, that's just one of the facts of history that often goes unexplored. Why is that even called Plymouth Rock? It's called Plymouth and Plymouth Rock because the venture, those Europeans, was underwritten by a corporation. And Plymouth was the corporation that underwrote their expedition. Mm-hmm. How appropriate is that the corporation is intruding in at the very, very earliest of the American narrative, that the corporation. Think about where we are now in 2010, in terms of the fascism that fascism essentially is corporatism, we look back to the history of this country, and it was a corporation that was right there at the beginning. Now, it was kind of like pre-capitalist. It was somewhat primitive capitalism, obviously, at that point in time in 1620, 1621. But nevertheless, it was the 17th century version of a corporation, the Plymouth Corporation, that underwrote the Pilgrim's expedition in to the so-called New World. You know, and the other thing too is why were they called Indians? You know, because going back to 1492, when Columbus and his cohorts came over, you know, they were lost. They were lost. They were seeking passage to India, and when they came across the islands, and they came across the indigenous people, they thinking that they were in or near India, they wrongly called them Indians, and so you know we have these important and yet overlooked elements of the historical narrative that need to be brought to light to understand exactly what was going on in the background there. And also, if we look to 1620, the year that you mentioned, 1620, 1621, and we think about, wow, you know, this is the first, you know, European incursion into the North American continent, and that's often the year or the range of time that we think about African slaves being brought to North America, and actually that's also not the whole story either, because already by 1620, the Spanish had settlements in the south of this continent in what's now Florida, and the Spaniards had brought slaves from Africa to North America. In the middle of the 16th century, some of the settlements that the Spanish had in Florida in the 1550s, they already had servants and slaves that they had kidnapped from Africa and brought to the so-called New World. So by 1620, it was the English folks who were beginning to settle in the north. The Spanish had already settled in the south in what's now Florida, and had already had for 70, 80 years at that point, African slaves in what's now the state of Florida. So, you know, we need to incorporate that and understand the broader context and the bigger picture to the history. So Plymouth is a corporation. The Indians is a misnomer because the Europeans were lost and they just applied this name. And, I think that goes – it demonstrates not just carelessness but a total indifference and a lack of respect on the part of Europeans toward other cultures. You know, they just decided they're going to call these people whatever the hell they wanted to call them, you know, and even though it was erroneous and it was wrong, they continued to call them Indians. Today we still use that nomenclature.
Right.
It demonstrates a total lack of respect for the other culture, and we could talk at length about the ideological disposition of Europeans and their total lack of respect, but we don't want to get too far off course. But I did want to highlight a couple of those historical features.
Yeah, and anyone, you know, obviously if you're listening right now, you're probably most likely listening online. You can just, you know, at the website you're at right now where you're listening online on blogtalkradio.com/your-world-news. You can just message us. If you want information, we got tons and tons of literature that we can send that's free. Have some actually free podcasts from indigenous historians. You know, getting into and real and very, very in depth around the whole derivation of this so-called holiday. So yeah, just message us and we will get you that information and make sure that you promise to send that information to friends and loved ones and all your contacts. That's the most important thing. Information and knowledge should not be should not be commodified. It should not be sold. It should be freely accessible and distributed widely. So the harvest feast, yeah, it did take a place around 1621, but the vast majority of those so-called Indians were not invited to attend that harvest feast. As we talked about before, they were not invited. So this was not the whole thing. When you see, you know, the pictures of this put on the face of so-called interracial, like this interracial harmony that these benevolent white people coming from Europe, you know, they just had it, you know, they just intrinsically had it inside them to see, you know, people of a different cultural background and very importantly, people of a different hue in terms of their skin color and facial features, they just saw these people as, oh man, you know, we just have it within us, you know, to see them as brothers as well. No, that's not the case. They saw them as savages. That's exactly how they depicted them. They saw them as savages. So despite the fact that these indigenous people helped and welcomed these European so-called settlers with open arms and taught them how to basically survive and not die in a world that was totally different to them. It wasn't new to indigenous people by any stretch of the imagination. They had been subsisting on Turtle Island, you know, North America for at least 10,000 years. It was only new to these European, what became known as savages. And so that was 1621, but it wasn't the thing that was dressed up. There was no turkey. There was no, they were very annoyed that Massasoit had invited, you know, his brothers and sisters to this harvest feast. And so that's the backdrop there. That's the scene that is the scene that is not painted for you in grammar schools, high schools, middle schools, and certainly not on corporate media or even in the back of these processions that we see at the Macy's Day Parade and so forth. But and then we look at the first actual, what they would deem as the first actual Thanksgiving, actually occurred in 1637. It was 1637. And what happened, the backdrop of that, all right, that also was not some kind of feast that was where they invited indigenous people. That was a day that they gave thanks. That was after they had slaughtered. That was a day that or a period in which there was mass slaughtering that went on. And these European savages, they as I said before, they drank at least a half a gallon of beer daily. They engaged in mass, rampant, promiscuous sodomy everywhere. You know what I'm saying? Everywhere throughout their infested villages. They brought with them disease that killed off. You know, let's give an example. There were more than 20,000. There were more than 20,000 indigenous folks, you know, within the Plymouth era before they got there. By the time it was all said and done, by the time it was all said and done, they were down to less than 750, and that was because of disease. That was because of mass slaughter, you know, left and right. So they were the savages, but they label the so-called Indians as the savages. And as Peter said, yes, they're misnomers, but as long as we continued not to, like, research the history, as long as we continue to, as some people say, oh, man, you're such a downer, man. Why are you talking about, come on, I just want to enjoy this day with my family. I was like, no one, you can enjoy the day with your family. I'm just trying to give you a backdrop so that you can actually empower your family with knowledge and push your family and your friends a little closer to humanity, which comes through compassion and understanding of the plight that these people went through. And it's understand, you know, and so that you, yourself, your friends and family don't continue the rest of your life glorifying serial killers, all right? You wouldn't glorify John Wayne Gacy. You wouldn't glorify Jeffrey Dahmer. So why would we sit here and glorify these savages that in, you know, around 1637, they wrapped they trapped about 700 Pequot Indians, mostly women, children, and elderly, near the mouth of what's known as the Mystic River, which is in Connecticut. And there was an Englishman by the name of John Mason, and he attacked the so-called Indian camp with fire and tomahawks, swords, rapiers, you know, like swords. Only a handful escaped. The vast majority of those 700 were burned to a crisp, had their scalps chopped off. They are the ones that really engaged in what we've come to know as scalping, and it was to their delight. You know what I'm saying? So you know, these people were sitting there frying to death. You know what it feels like to be burned when you burn your finger, your hand on the stovetop. All right, these folks were burned. Their entire bodies were burned. All right, and so they were literally frying, and blood and screams. Blood ran into the river. It was a horrible stench, something that I'm not making this up, where they praised their Lord, their God. They praised their God, and that right there, folks, that event marked the first actual Thanksgiving. That was a day where the folks like John Mason, where they praised and they gave thanks to God, to their God. All right, and this is an actual day of giving thanks to this bountiful land that we have now inherited, and what they did to those indigenous people was justified, and they used God, God, their God, as a justification for doing that. And so I'll just end on this. And so within the 10 years. You had more than 12,000 white invaders throughout New England. Their numbers continue to grow, where at the same time the population of the indigenous people, based on disease and murder, we saw their population decline to less than about 750. But it was around 24,000, and the European settlers, so-called settlers, in Massachusetts alone, within 10 years, rose to more than 20,000. And so, you know, by 1946, when we chart the first so-called Thanksgiving in 1937, so within 10 years, went to 20,000. So that's, you know, I want to say this as we move along, Peter, and everyone that's listening, is that it's important to understand when we look at these holidays that it's not just two radical guys just teeing off on this fallacy of history and trying to write history. Yes, we are. We are correcting history that has been purposely like lied about, omitted. We're doing that. We're talking about it in a way that it should be discussed in colleges and universities and even high schools across America. But beyond that, what we're trying to do is connect the dots and understand that when you have a country that celebrates these people without discussion, without dialogue, when you have a country that celebrates this, when you have a country that has a federal holiday around a rapist, murderer, genocider, as we do with Cristobal Colon, otherwise known as Christopher Columbus, it lays the groundwork, people, for mass carnage that is done in our name today, in places right. like Iraq, Afghanistan. So when you look at the 1 million Iraqis civilians that have been killed since the U.S. invaded that country, all right, 2003-2004, and no mention of it on the corporate media in that context and how illegal it is. The scene has already been set. The apathy and the disregard for human life in America, in most Americans,
It's already been set. It's already been set. That's why they don't give a damn. That's why your average American doesn't give a damn about those numbers. They just simply don't give a damn about those numbers because it's all being done in the name of conquest, the same way that it's about the name of conquest and bringing so-called civilization in these terms. In 2010, we don't use the word civilization, but the coded word that we use is that we're bringing democracy. Democracy. So just like the settlers came here and these savages, we have to give them civilization the same way they felt they needed to give civilization and culture to indigenous Africans. that's what they felt they were bringing to the Americas. And they brought it with a Bible and with a sword, a rapier, with fire, with evil. And so that is why we see these holidays today being the backdrop and setting the stage for the understanding that, hey, this is okay. As a matter of fact, there's not even thought about it being okay or not, Peter. It's so ingrained in their subconscious that what was done to these indigenous folks was right. Even if people learn about, you know what I'm saying? So when they learn about the resistance that indigenous folks put up, they look at these folks were savages, and so they attacked these white folks that were just trying to civilize them and trying to build up their land, you know, infrastructurally and give them a better life. And so those savages that rose up, they got what they deserved. That they got what they deserved. You know, they were savages. They had to be put down like rabid dogs. That's exactly. And so those Iraqi that so-called insurgents, who are not a part of Al Qaeda, who are just fighting back, they're seen as savages that need to be put down. And you know, thanks to the work of WikiLeaks, seeing that video called Collateral Murder, we see that it's embedded in the culture of the military, and it permeates itself through every crevice and nook and cranny of American society.
You're getting right to the heart of the matter, Solomon. And a couple of things I want to elaborate on. I'm so glad you framed it by saying, you know, we want to connect the dots. Yeah, obviously this is much, much more than just ranting. We want to talk about the historical reality that's behind the Thanksgiving holiday, and to really bring that to the consciousness of our listeners, and hopefully our listeners will think long and hard about that, will critically assimilate the information, will find more information for themselves, and we'll talk about that stuff hopefully today, you know, over the dinner table, for those folks who are going to take part in, you know, some of these traditional observations. Talk about this stuff over the dinner table. You know, I have to wonder, would people just uncritically and blindly continue to celebrate the way that they do this the so-called Thanksgiving if people knew the facts, if people knew the real facts and the real history and the barbarism on the atrocities and the inhumanity and the murder and the genocide and the democide that was taking place? Would folks really just go about business as usual? Yeah, you know what? Some people probably will. But there's got to be a number of folks who, you know, once their eyes are opened and once they learn the truth, that they're going to stop just sleepwalking and going through the motions. You know, I'm one of those people. You know, when I started to realize what was really going on, when I started to learn the truth, and I started to have the blinders taken off and really learn for myself the historical reality. I got pissed off, Solomon. You know, it made me angry because I had been lied to all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I had been lied to. We're being lied to. You know, every time this Thanksgiving mythology gets passed on and handed down and talked about, we're being lied to. You know, every time when we were kids and we made those little cute little pilgrims and little turkeys in grade school and all that stuff that goes into that, we're being lied to. and the mythology and the lies and the fabrications are being passed on, and then we're expected to pass that stuff along to the next generations, you know. And so, you know, that pissed me off. That really makes me angry, you know, that I'd been lied to my whole life and that I was expected to pass on the lies to the next generations and to people that I came in contact with. You know, that really troubles me. And hopefully if folks are equipped with the facts, with reality, maybe they'll stop allowing themselves to be lied to. And maybe they'll stop and say, no more. You know, I'm not going to be lied to anymore, and I refuse to pass down your lies. I refuse to do that. So definitely much more than a rant, you know, and just dropping the facts and dropping the reality. And like you said, what's the point? Part of the point is to connect the dots, because what happened in the 17th century, the 1620s, 1630s, and that whole fabrication, it is absolutely connected to what's going on in the 21st century. Absolutely right. Connected to what's going on in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and what many in the government would like to do in Iran and in Pakistan and in Yemen and in Haiti and in Grenada and in Colombia and all over the planet. Yeah, we need to understand that. And we need to understand that, you know, as you mentioned, the way the Europeans objectified the indigenous peoples that they came across. You know, there's this ideology of the cultural other. You know, and Europeans and now Euro-Americans are unique, really, anthropologically. They're relatively unique in terms of having this concept of a cultural other, in which any group of people that are outside of themselves are automatically objectified and seen as either inferior or seeing, you know, they're hostile toward them, and it's just a fact of anthropology and a fact of history. So, you know, this isn't stuff I'm making up. And so that's the approach that Europeans took towards the indigenous peoples of the Caribbean, of what's now North America, what's now South America and Central America, and it is still happening today. You know, like you said, let's connect the dots. Let's make 1630 real. Well, let's just look on the other side of the globe to what's going on in the Middle East today, in terms of the same type of expansionism is going on, and the same type of ideology is being applied in Iraq and Afghanistan. We call those people insurgents. Well, yeah, that's just a new name for, like you said, savages. They were savages back then. They're insurgents today, or they're terrorists today. That's a catch-all term that allows the U.S. government to just murder anybody they want to. They call them a terrorist, you know, and so they can persecute and terrorize and murder with impunity anybody that they just decide to throw underneath that umbrella of being a terrorist. And, you know, going back to the concept of Plymouth and the Plymouth Rock, okay, Plymouth was the corporation, and obviously it was the corporations of England that needed new resources because, you know, in those early days of what we call pre-capitalism, you know, yeah, they needed new resources. They needed new raw materials. They needed new markets. In modern language, you know, that's what they were after. That's what they needed to expand. And so, if you look at what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Plymouth of the 21st century is who? Solomon, Enron, Bechtel, BP, Lockheed Martin,
Halliburton.
The Carlyle Group, Halliburton, Boeing, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the same ideology. And it's the same demented and twisted hegemony from a cultural and from an economic perspective that is being perpetrated today by the heirs of those early pilgrims all over the world. So yeah, there is definitely a connection to what's going on right now in November of 2010 to what was going on in the 1630s. So, you know, it's more than a history lesson. Much more than a history lesson. But
exactly.
we can pull out of that narrative some of these realities, like the objectification that we see. You know,
right.
and that's a big one, because not only is it taking place in Iraq and Afghanistan, but let's look at what's going on in the American Southwest right now. I mean, Arizona is leading the way with all these racist laws and legislation. You know, the SB 1070 and the anti ethnic studies laws and so forth. So it's the same kind of racist and domination system driven ideology that is still functioning today, and we need to recognize those things. And the first way to do that is to understand our history in order to understand and be able to recognize what's going on in the world today. Because the things that are happening today, they didn't just sprout up out of nowhere. You know, they're rooted
yeah.
in the history. They're rooted in the history of the hegemonic people that came from Europe and have spread over the globe. You know, like a virus.
Right.
And so, you know, if we understand that, can we still sit around the table? Ask, you know, folks need to ask themselves, can you still sit around the table today and laugh and joke and stuff yourself with food based on that history? And
yeah,
not only
exactly.
that history, not only that history, but the current events that are spinoffs of that history that are going on, not just in, you know, the far corners of the globe, but right here in this country. Let's look at racial profiling. Let's look at the incarceration of black and brown people in this country. Let's look at police murder and police brutality. Those are all the spinoffs of the ideology that gave us Thanksgiving. And so you can't
right.
sit around your dinner table today and just have a good time and act as if everything is just fine and everybody's having an equal piece of the pie, because that's not. You know, the fact of the matter is that the majority of people on this planet are hungry today. And we'll wake up this morning hungry, and we'll go to bed tonight hungry. Why? Because of the ideology of Plymouth Rock. And so that's the reality of the day, and that's the mindset that people that have any kind of intellectual integrity need to embrace that reality and think otherwise and then behave otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah. And as we were talking about before, as I was saying before, with the resistance to the kind of bring our summary of this story to a brief close is that you look at the resistance and so these vile, savage European invaders by the year 1675 they waged a full scale war with the Wampanoags and directly against the great Wampanoag chief Metacomet, and these unoriginal Europeans renamed him King Philip. So they renamed him King Philip, but his name was Chief Metacomet, and they gave him The settlers gave him an ultimatum. They basically said, you know, your people. I mean, the audacity. This was his people's land. This was his people's land, and they in essence told him that they would need permission for a range of things. To you know what I'm saying in terms of selling their land or what have you, you know. So they basically had these humiliating rules, you know. One of which was that, you know, he could not sell his own land without the prior approval from white people. So in order for him to sell or do something with his land to other folks, you know, he had to get prior approval from whites. They also demanded him that he turn his community's firearms and weapons in. all right? And this basically, you know, would be marking them for extermination, you know. And so, you know, what happened was they, you know, they in 1675, met a comet and his people retaliated, justifiably so, power to them, you know what I'm saying? And they retaliated and they attacked, there were at the time 92 New England towns, about 90 New England towns, and they attacked 52 of those towns. They attacked 52 of those towns, and they destroyed 13 of them. You know, praise to them. So glad. But so they destroyed 13 of those towns. The Englishmen, you know, they ultimately persevered in this war. They regrouped, and they destroyed, you know, the entire Wampanoag Nation at that time, and this was just half a century. This was just like a little over 50 years after their initial arrival on Massachusetts soil. And what did they do to Metacomet? What did they do to him? They killed him. Yeah, that's the least. There was an individual by the name of Benjamin Church, who was an Englishman, and he tracked down Metacomet and caught up to him in 1676. I believe it was, and they quartered his body, removed his arms, his legs, as we said before, and those parts were left for the wolves. They took his hands, they cut his hands off, and they sent those hands off to Boston, and his head went to Plymouth. And Plymouth, that's where they took his head and stuck it into a pole, and, you know, and that was, they stuck it on a pole on the real, you know, the real first day of public Thanksgiving for the, you know, for the avenging and revenge upon their enemy. And so that was what was said, you know, quote, day of public Thanksgiving for the beginning of revenge upon the enemy. That was Benjamin Church's, you know, quote. Metacomet's 9-year-old son was slated to be murdered. They decided to not murder him, and they sent him on a ship to the Caribbean, where his son, his 9-year-old son, spent the rest of his life in slavery. He spent the rest of his life in slavery. So these are like the stories. So this was nothing less than a Holocaust. This was without a Holocaust. If what happened to Ashkenazi Jews and Gypsies, homosexuals and political dissenters and Germany, it was a Holocaust. This was nothing short of a Holocaust. You know,
right.
That term cannot be monopolized by any one group. There have been many Holocausts. This was without a doubt a Holocaust. That was imposed, that was set forth on these people by white European invaders, without a doubt. You know, there was mass carnage, and Metacomet and his people they resisted what was being imposed upon them, and they fought back, and you know, they took 13, destroyed 13 towns in the process, but instead of, you know, they fought back because they were not going to die softly. They were not going to die quietly. They were not going to have their dignity continue to be removed from themselves, and they weren't going to just patiently wait for the inevitable, which was going to be, you know, either slavery or death. And they fought back, but these barbarians, I mean, you know, they quartered his body. And another thing I want to mention, Peter, is one of the other vile things that they had done before also. You know, and some of their raids and murderous pillages, they would actually, as they were cutting people up, like men, specifically men, they would cut pieces of their body off, chunks of their body off, and they would shove it in their mouth and feed them their own, and make them eat their own flesh. Little, you know, as vile as it is to hear, you know, it's more vile, it's more
right.
detestable to actually go through. All right. So
yes.
I tell those stories, you know, in deference to those people who lost their lives like that. And so, and as we know, in 1863, this became a national holiday by none other than Honest Abe. Abe Lincoln declared this day as a day of Thanksgiving. Well, not a day of Thanksgiving, but declared the day of Thanksgiving a national holiday in 1863. And this holiday is rooted in nothing other than white supremacy, blood. It's obviously mass propaganda. We've talked about the Benjamin Churches, the John Winthrops, the William Bradfords, these vile human beings, and the people who accept it, because at the time, you know, I don't give a damn if there was a woman in the town that that didn't actually kill somebody. If you didn't do something, if you were complicit with it, you were in my estimation, you were just as culpable as the folks that were that raised their rapier or raised their sword and brought it down to the neck or brought it down to the skull of a Wampanoag woman or a Wampanoag boy. But they were complicit in this because they saw what they were reaping. They were reaping, you know, massive amounts of land, of arable land, mass amounts of arable land, and with that the nature and the unlimited amount of deer that are there, the geese, all that stuff, ducks, you know what I'm saying? All that stuff, you know, for them to eat, for that soil for them to plant on. And so they were like, hey, the ends justify the means. Better them than us. You know what I'm saying? We're here now. We came over here now. And the ironic thing is, Peter, they were escaping persecution in their own mother country, escaping persecution. And they brought that same vibe with the fucking hypocrites. And they brought that to the so-called New World and started and took it and said, you know what? We're going to take it up a notch. We're gonna what was done to us, all right? We're gonna take it up a notch on these folks. We're gonna up the ante, as they say. You know, it's fourth quarter. We're about to take it up a damn notch to the next level, and we're gonna brutalize and just annihilate these people, quarter them, cut their heads off, split their skulls, you know, feed them their own flesh, burn them to death, and have the audacity to call them savages. To call them savages. That is the backdrop of this Thanksgiving holiday, folks. And there are many other little tiny nuances and larger nuances in terms of details in this story that could be told. And that's why I said, you know, make sure you message us and we'll send you tons of articles. You know, matter of fact, there's about six solid articles that we'll send you, as long as you promise to read them, not just once, but three or four times. You can't read it once and get the basic gist of it. When I learned about this stuff, probably the same thing that you did, Peter, I read it. I read these pieces no less than six or seven times for me to really fully, like, imbibe and have this stuff, like, sink in, not for me to walk around and oh, I fucking know all this shit. You know, no, you know, for me to really comprehensively understand the gravity of what went on, the gravity, as you said, Peter, to how we've been lied to. And so, I could take that information and bequeath it upon every person that was close to me that I could. And I, in closing, before I turn back over to you, Peter, is that, listen, people, be the damn inconvenient hero at your dinner table today. If you're going to be attending some Thanksgiving meal where you know the vast amount of people are caught up in this mythology and are just blissfully happy in their own ignorance, be the inconvenient hero. Tell this story. Talk to them about it. Bring this up at the dinner table. When they're talking about the Patriots playing the Detroit Lions and this, that, and the other, and the little turkey that they bring out, that, you know, at halftime, and they have the player who gets MVP pull the turkey leg out, and at halftime, guaranteed at halftime, they'll have some people dressed up as settlers. Tell the story. Be the inconvenient hero. Who gives a damn if they don't like what you hear? Bring it up, because somebody there may benefit from that knowledge, even though
the most of them are somebody, you know what I'm saying, or your a-hole uncle, you know, is just a vile human being in terms of being racist or just being insensitive. Who cares if he's just going to rebuff everything you say? There's maybe somebody else at that dinner table, at that meal table today, that information can do wonders for.
Yeah, definitely. I just want to echo that sentiment that the folks who are interested and are willing to read the material, please, by all means, get in touch with us so that we can send you some information, some links, some titles, some names, so that you can find this stuff out for yourself. You know, don't take our word for it. Do the reading yourself. Do the reading that we've done. Do the research that we've done. It's out there. It's abundant. Look into it. But anyway, you know, the history behind that Solomon in terms of Metacomet's murder and the fact that there was this big feast, this big celebration, and they were giving thanks for the fact that they were in the process of committing genocide. They were in the process of committing democide. And that's another element or big aspect of the history of Thanksgiving that just gets ignored, gets written out, it gets forgotten because it's inconvenient. And again, would folks sit around their table today and stuff themselves and be jolly and be happy if they knew that the reason that those first pilgrims were giving thanks and feasting was because they were in the they had just set off this genocidal holocaust that would eventually take the lives of, you know, untold millions and tens of millions of indigenous people's lives? You know, that's really the historical backdrop for this holiday. You know, and so it wasn't, like you mentioned, Solomon, you know, up until the 1860s, it was an informal holiday. It was observed in different ways, and then it was in the 1860s that Honest Abe Lincoln made it a federal holiday. And it's interesting, what would be the motivation for an American president to establish Thanksgiving Day as a holiday at that particular point in time? I mean, if we think about what's going on in the 1860s during the presidency of Abraham Lincoln, what's going on in this country and the role and the purpose of a day like Thanksgiving in the whole drama that's unfolding in the United States. Obviously the Civil War is tearing the country apart literally in two over the racial hostilities and slavery. And the other aspect is the massive influx of immigrants, mostly from Europe, that were coming into the country on the East Coast and then on the West Coast. During the 1840s, 1850s, and 1860s, we saw there was an influx of immigrants from China and Japan and some of the Pacific seaboard countries. And so a national holiday such as Thanksgiving, what that does is it provides a unifying narrative around which all these immigrants can identify themselves as Americans, because it's the kind of thing that everybody can participate in. Everybody can partake of this Thanksgiving holiday. Everybody can give thanks, right, for all the blessings that we have, right? And so there's this narrative that was crafted and created and you know, intentionally fabricated. It was an intentional fabrication so that the immigrants could buy into this and start to almost see themselves, almost begin to identify with those first pilgrims of the 17th century as these people coming to a new world and to take of its bounty, right? So there's this narrative that's being created to intentionally get people to think in a uniform manner and to think in a fashion that is ahistorical and acritical, all right? Ahistorical. In other words, it doesn't think about the genocide and the barbarity and the white supremacy that undergirds the reality of historical Thanksgiving, okay? It's acritical in that it doesn't think. It, you know, folks aren't encouraged to think. You know, they didn't have Blog Talk Radio having a discussion about what's the underpinnings and what's the background to this Thanksgiving holiday that was being declared by
right.
the president. No, it was ahistorical, it was acritical, but it was a narrative. And it's part of that narrative that the new immigrants were being encouraged to write themselves into it, to develop this unified wholeness of being American. And we see that, you know, so that sense of Americanism is being further strengthened in the 1860s and since then, as this, you know, Thanksgiving is this day that we all participate in. Everybody does it, right? Because we're all Americans. I'll tell you what, I just, you know, especially now, it is so noticeable to me, because I don't celebrate Thanksgiving, it is so noticeable to me in the weeks leading up to and the days leading up to Thanksgiving, the comments that people make to me. Are you ready for Thanksgiving? You know, or what are you having for Thanksgiving dinner? Because there's just this assumption that we all do it. And so, again, it's still acritical. Nobody stops to think about what we're doing, why we're doing it. And when I tell people that I don't celebrate it, that I'm not doing Thanksgiving, there's just this, you know, people are just totally dumbfounded. You know, it's like, what? Huh? It's just shocking. And
right.
so that demonstrates the power of the narrative in which, we, you know, people are basically propagandized or brainwashed into seeing all of us as part of this wonderful, happy story when it's not, when it's none of those things. When it's none of those things, so it's, you know, it's really an insidious yet very effective attempt to kind of homogenize a very unique people that we have in this country. The other element of it, and this goes back to something you said earlier that I just have to touch on, was how the early invaders. They thank their God. They thank their God, and they pray to God for all of these wonderful blessings, which was basically what? Killing the indigenous people, taking the abundance of material wealth that they found from those people, and then returning that with death and destruction. They thank their God for that. And think about what's going on around dinner tables today. People are going to start off their Thanksgiving dinner with, you know, this prayer of thanks. Now, the national holiday, it's not couched in religious language, you know, for obvious reasons. But the implication is very clear. Well, who do we give thanks to? Well, we give thanks to God. We give thanks to God for all this abundance, you know. And that, to me, is an absolute, you know, to use Glenn's language again, it's an affront to civilization. To think that there's this God of white supremacy, this God of white domination, this God of white cultural superiority, that people in this country are going to give thanks to for all of the for what? For the history that we just laid bare? Give thanks to God for that? What kind of God do you worship? What kind of God do you pray to? Who is this God? And that's another question that we need to take very seriously, is the American Christianity that has been developed over these past centuries. And it goes back to the early days, the pilgrims, the first invaders, those first Thanksgivings, and the beginning of that whole narrative, because God has been woven into that narrative at every step of the way. And so the God that folks are praying to today around the dinner table for Thanksgiving in 2010 is this obscenity. It is, this God is an obscenity. And we need to take a step back from the dinner table. We need to take a step back from whatever we're doing and examine not only the history, not only the holiday, but also our theology and our religion and our Christianity particularly. What kind of God is it? Who would, you know, not allow this to happen? Not only allow it to happen, but then give his blessing on it. What kind of obscene theology is that, Solomon? That is utterly disgusting. You know, if the God of the Bible were real, then that God would step in and stand up for the indigenous people who are being murdered. if that God were real, that God would step in and take a stand with the oppressed, would take a stand for those who were being raped and being murdered and being dismembered and being cut up into pieces and being burned alive. Not for the self-righteous and almighty Europeans who were stepping into this new world to claim it for themselves. And that's the God who Americans are praying to when you see these cute little ribbons and stickers on people's cars. You know, God bless the troops.
Right.
Excuse me? It's that same theology, Solomon, that same theology, this God of white supremacy, this God of cultural hegemony, that they want to bless the wars that are being perpetrated in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world, so that white America can rule the world. That's the God. That's what that means. God bless our troops. God bless our troops for what? God bless the troops so they can kill those brown people better. God bless the troops so they can kill those Iraqis and those Afghans better, so that they can kill more Pakistanis, so they can kill more Iranians. God bless us and no one else is what that means. And that is another level of effrontery that this holiday brings to light, that people will thank God for all these wonderful things. Well, where's God in all this when, as I mentioned, that, you know, half of the planet is going to wake up today hungry and go to bed tonight hungry on this day where Americans stuff themselves to the point of bursting?
Yeah.
Where's God in all that, you know? So what kind of narrative is it? What kind of obscene narrative is it? You know, that's pornographic right there. That's a pornographic story right there. You know, that there's this God that is on the side of the murderous and oppressive invaders who continue their invasions, you know, several centuries later, different parts
right.
of the world. So, you know, so not just the history, but the current events, not just the anthropology and the ideology, but also the religion. I mean, it's obscene on so many levels, Solomon. On so many levels, you know, it's repugnant and it's repulsive. It really is. It really is.
Right. And you know, there's so many things you mentioned that triggered a lot in my mind. But when you look at just the whole symbolism behind like stuffing yourselves and gorging yourselves on this day, I mean, that's just a microcosm of what America represents. America represents, in the larger global scheme, 5% of the world's population, but America gobbles up 27% of her of the world's resources. America
right.
produces over 25% of the world's waste, and
yep.
so you know that that's so symbolic because if the world is like a human being, I mean. You know, you're 5%, and you're 5%, and you're eating enough food. You know what I'm saying? Five times over of over what your actual weight is, and then you're shitting out. You know, that 25%. You know, in waste that is just out there in the street, out there. You know what I'm saying? It's too much for your toilet, so it overruns. You know, and
right.
so that waste is too much. It'd be one thing if it was just confined to the U.S. Borders, but it's not. As you know, any idiot knows that the waste that is provided by Western nations such as the U.S. Impacts adversely developing nations that are not responsible for producing the mass amounts of waste out there, and so
they literally ship it around the world on barges.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Matter of fact, when that whole thing a couple of years ago was going on about some of the Somali pirates, well, some of those Somali pirates were protecting their shores from those ships that were dumping toxic waste,
right?
You know,
right.
off their shore. You know, some of those Somali pirates were protecting you know, their waters from being overfished, you know. And so these are the stories that you know. So the corporate media is just going to present, you know, half the story and talk about, you know, a certain portion of the Somali pirates that are just, you know, that are just doing it for all the you know, the wrong reasons, but while not talking about the ones who are actually protecting their people, protecting their land, protecting the environment against you know, these Western corporations and their ships that go in there. And one story I forgot to mention, you know, before we go to this Black Agenda Report clip, is it's really, really important to talk about a vile individual by the name of Miles Standish.
Yeah.
Miles Standish was an individual who led a company of pilgrims into a indigenous village, and he masked himself as a traitor. But before this, I mean, he delivered. This is, see, like the harsher, you know, when juries and judges are handing out crimes, you know, typically in America for like murder, you're gonna do hard time, or you face life imprisonment or face the death penalty, if they find out that this was premeditated, that you know, the boyfriend thought about, you know, he thought about killing his mates or his partner, you know. Or his wife, you know, days in advance, months in advance, weeks in advance. Well, this was premeditated murder. Miles Standish and his company of savage thugs, these pilgrims, they sought to chop up the head of a local chief, and they wanted to do this. They wanted to bring this head back again to, you know, to Plymouth, aforementioned Plymouth, and put it on a stake. And so that's exactly what they did. They went in there. And they chopped up the head of an Indian man. His name was Witu Wamet, and they you know, beheaded him. And behead people mean, you know, they clear chopped the dude's head off and brought it to Plymouth, and it was displayed as a symbol. They put on a wooden spike, and it was there for several years, and it was a symbol of white power. It was deliberately sought to, you know, they were deliberately seeking out the head of an Indian chief. They you know, they got the head of this Indian man, Witu Wamet, who met his demise by having his head removed from his body and then stuck on a wooden stake, and stuck on a woman's wooden stake and placed in Plymouth for the simple reason. Just to serve as a symbol of white power and to warn and to forewarn, you know, other indigenous people that listen. This is what we're about. So when you talk about savages, you know, who are the original scalpers? Who are the original savages? It was those scumbag savage European settlers. And when we talk about what's going on today, and Peter, you give a great segue. I'm going to play this clip. I want people to understand because, you know, much like in America, we have very short-term memories. You know, for some reason, you know, when something bad happens, you know, we're protecting our little American cocoon, and we oh man, those poor Haitians. You know, let me just send some clothes one time or send some money
right.
One time, and not do the background homework in terms of how these people became so poor. And to really, you know, have a prolonged push towards truly emancipating these people from structural adjustment policies from the IMF that are controlled and dictated by the U.S. and righting the wrongs caused by coups in the 90s and 2004, so that these people can really finally, for once since their independence, 1804. Actually have true liberation and independence from and justice, you know, in the form of reparations. We don't want to do that. We want to just talk about we can send some clothes one time and feel fucking good about it. Just feel good about ourselves. Yeah, I send
right.
some clothes. I feel good about it. So, but I'll tell you what, Haitians have resistance. If there's one thing they have within They are strong and resistant people. And I want to play this clip by Brother Glenn Ford in Black Agenda Report.
If you want to know what the rulers of the United States would do if they had unchecked power to order the world as they saw fit, look at Haiti. It is in Haiti that the United States shows its true face, a face of infinite greed, boundless cruelty, absolute cynicism, naked aggression, and a total lack of respect for human dignity, especially the dignity of black humanity. Since 2004, Haiti has been a de facto colony of the United States. By organizing and funding the armed coup that toppled the freely elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and then physically kidnapping and transporting him into African exile, the United States made itself responsible for everything that has transpired since. This is a principle embedded in international laws of war, of conquest, that the conqueror takes responsibility for the welfare and safety of the vanquished population. The rationale is simple. By conquering a people and seizing authority over the defeated country, the conqueror assumes the responsibility to protect the inhabitants and their human rights, since the conquered people have lost the means to provide and ensure that for themselves. The United States helped codify that principle into international law more than 60 years ago, but fundamentally violates its spirit every day in Haiti. The Americans claim they didn't overthrow President Aristide, but simply had their Marines transport him to safety. The Bush administration installed in Haitian government the most vicious pack of criminals ever assembled in the Americas, and watched while these hand-picked degenerates murdered thousands. But the U.S. claimed that was not their responsibility, since America had not conquered Haiti. The U.S. joined with a long-ago colonial ruler, France, and the New Jack colonialist, Canada, to figure out what to do with Haiti without seeming like they were legally responsible. The great white powers snapped their fingers and the United Nations appeared. Haiti became a kind of international protectorate, which is something like being everybody's colony. But no one doubted, certainly not the Haitians, that the UN was just a blue-helmeted security service for Uncle Sam, that Haiti was a U.S. possession in every practical sense of the term. If any fool thought differently, last January's catastrophic earthquake proved that the United States was the occupying power in charge. The Americans seized the Port-au-Prince airport, blockaded the coast, and sent in 22,000 troops whose word was law in Haiti. Washington did all of this unilaterally, as if they had every legal right, which it would have if the Americans acknowledged themselves as the conquering power. But of course, that would mean the U.S. was obligated to spend as many billions as it takes on the human needs of the people of Haiti, not as a matter of charity, but as a solemn legal responsibility. After all, the U.S. took their government from them. The Americans prefer to deny that they are the power in charge while pulling all the strings, including keeping former President Aristide's party, the most popular in the country, out of the November 28 election. This is how the Americans would rule the world if they could, standing on everybody's necks. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Yeah, this piece right here is it's instructive on a lot of different levels in terms of the United States disposition towards Haiti, is clearly reflective of the United States government's disposition towards other nations and other peoples around the world. Glenn Ford highlights the just a couple of the more egregious characteristics,
right, exactly,
of U.S. foreign policy, like naked aggression. We talked about that just in terms of the naked aggression with relation to the indigenous peoples with in the whole Thanksgiving conversation. The disregard for humanity, again, more of the same. I mentioned that earlier. Just this,
right,
the concept of the cultural other, that you know, that Euro Americans, they just, you know, they have a total disregard, total disrespect for anything, for any cultural, any people outside of themselves.
Right.
And if we again, since we're looking back historically today in terms of Thanksgiving, if we look back historically in terms of the United States' relationship with Haiti, it's just definitive, and it's instructive about the United States' real disposition. You know, that's what's wonderful about Glenn's piece, is that, you know, he really unmasks the true intentions and the true characteristics,
right,
of the United States just by putting the facts out about Haiti, just the facts. You know, Glenn's
exactly,
not going on a rant. He's not developing an idea. He's just saying these are the facts. So this is the way the,
right,
United States has been. If we could look at the disposition towards the United States when the United States was a fledgling so-called democracy in the 1790s, after it had gained sovereignty from the British Crown,
yeah,
what country just right off its coast was in the same struggle of throwing off colonial domination from a European power?
Okay.
It was
exactly
what's now Haiti. And what was the,
yeah,
United States' disposition towards Haiti or at that time, Santo,
right,
Domingo? What was their disposition towards their revolution to throw off a,
right,
colonial oppressor? Did they support,
right,
them?
Right.
Did they support,
Peter,
their revolution?
Right. We have a caller, Peter, really quick. I want to pass them through.
Yeah,
before,
yeah.
Caller, you're on the line. Do you have a quick comment or question? Hello? Caller?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the line.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about Haiti. Last year I was at the Black Power Conference in Atlanta, well, actually earlier this year, and they had the ambassador of Haiti as a guest speaker, and he was talking about Haiti's economic development post hurricane of post the earthquake, and all the things that they were going through to try to rebuild. And he mentioned that Haiti had took out a series of loans with the IMF and the World Bank in order to rebuild. And so he, at the end of his lecture, he opened it up for questions and answers. And I asked him, did Haiti still have its sovereignty? And he kind of tiptoed around the issue, and I basically wouldn't let it go. And I got him to admit that in order for Haiti to secure these loans with the IMF and World Bank in order to rebuild, Haiti basically had to give up their sovereignty.
Right.
And when he admitted,
right,
that, you know, the whole vibe of the audience, they
wow,
were basically turned off by what he was saying, because he was standing there in defense of American policy towards Haiti.
Right.
But if we don't, and I'm just saying that to make a point that if we don't question these people, especially when we know that we have information that's being from the people, you know, folks like Ambassador can come in front of us and say anything and get away with it.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, brother. I really appreciate your comment. And actually, since you brought that up, there's a piece that I think that you'll really appreciate that speaks volumes. And I wasn't initially going to play this, but it speaks to exactly what you're hitting on. And you know, those folks that are in power, those ambassadors, and even the folks that are in power are not the folks that the people are backing. The people that are backing these individuals are these corporations, these Western corporations, U.S. and Western, you know, Western countries such as U.S. and France and Canada are backing these folks because they're willing to do the bidding and the interest, not for the people of Haiti, but for the people of those nations and the corporations that they represent. And so I want to play this clip for you, brother, and I want to actually keep you on the line and have you comment on after this piece right here on Haiti and the upcoming elections there.
The United States, having stolen Haiti's government in a 2004 coup and reinvaded the country with 22,000 troops after last January's catastrophic earthquake, now foists a farce of an election on the cholera-racked nation. It is an election designed not to allow the Haitian people to express their political aspirations, but to impose a veil of legality on the theft of Haiti's sovereignty and independence by U.S. imperialism and its allies. In other words, this Sunday, when a small minority of Haitians go through the motions of casting votes for a president, they will in effect be participating in the very opposite of a democratic process. This election is not for their benefit. It does not enhance the power of Haiti's people to determine their own destiny. Rather, it is a charade paid for by the United States to provide a veneer of legitimacy to America's colonization of Haiti. Whoever is eventually chosen among the 19 candidates for president, most likely in a runoff election between the two top vote-getters in January, he or she could not possibly be the choice of the Haitian people. That's because the party of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Fanmi Lavalas, which is by far the most popular political organization in the country, has once again been barred from taking part in the election. As a result, and also because of widespread opposition to holding elections at all when cholera is raging in the country, turnout will be low and the outcome unsatisfactory to the majority of people, which is the only kind of outcome that the United States will tolerate. The American ambassador to Haiti, Kenneth Merton, who is a notorious liar, nevertheless spoke the truth when he told the Washington Post that he hadn't met anybody among the contenders that he can't work with. The United States owns this election because Washington has paid for it. The nominal cost is $15 million for Sunday's election machinery. But one must also factor in the cost of arming and training the death squads that swept into Haiti from U.S. finance bases in the Dominican Republic to reverse, by violence, the Haitian people's electoral choices in 2004. U.S. costs for colonization of Haiti include funding and organizing the minority political opposition to President Aristide so that the majority's will could be thwarted. And it includes the huge expense of bribing and orchestrating the United Nations to become a kind of 12,000-man rent-a-cop security outfit for the occupation of Haiti against the people's will. What the U.S. is paying for in this election is a grotesque caricature of a vote that will produce a nominal president who will sit as a pitiful figurehead over a state that has no power. Real power belongs to the Haiti Recovery Commission, co-chaired by former U.S. President Bill Clinton, and totally dominated by foreign governments and bankers whose mission is to restore Haiti to the colonial status it escaped two centuries ago. Through blockades and invasions and coups and finally electioneering theatrics, the Americans think they have purchased a black Creole-speaking colony in the Caribbean. They will soon find out they have bought an island of resistance. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Yeah, brother, if you would like to comment on that clip, we'd appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks. See, he covered everything that needed to be covered. The fact that we really need someone on the ground in Haiti that can report what's actually going on, because if we rely on American media to give us the real deal, situation that's going on in Haiti, we're going to stay in the dark. I mean, I know Democracy Now, they usually reports on you know, things in Haiti, but I don't even trust them. I don't trust anybody that does not represent our community and our nation to give us the fair information in regards to Haiti. And now, with this new outbreak of cholera, I really think that is being used as a weapon against the Haitian people. Because if you look at the time that the earthquake happened, there was no cholera outbreak then. And cholera just became an issue over the last 2 or 3 months. And cholera is something, I don't know if you've ever been to so-called third world countries, but when a disaster strikes, cholera spreads almost within the first couple of weeks, because that is the time where people are more susceptible to sickness and disease, okay? So to have the Haitian people now have to deal with cholera almost a year after the earthquake seems somewhat puzzling to me. Well, I already know it. Like I said, I think it's being used as a weapon. And I think that cholera is being put in the Haitian water supply. Now, I was in Haiti back in 1995. And one thing that I can say about being in Haiti, the people of Haiti, like the brother said in the piece, they are true revolutionary people, 100%. That is a nationalist country. They have a lot of pride in what they've done throughout history, and they have a lot of pride in self-esteem about being the only true Western democracy, African Western democracy in the Western Hemisphere. They take a lot of pride in that. And so we can't just assume that because America is able to come with a lot of money backed by the World Bank and the IMF and the United Nations that they're going to – the Haitian people are going to just lay down and let them walk over them. They're going to find a spirit of resistance on that island that they have never encountered, even in Afghanistan.
Right. You're right. Really appreciate your comments, and thanks for calling in. I couldn't agree with you more. I could not agree with you more. And yeah, I've been to so-called third world nations, and you're right on point in terms of the cholera outbreak. And, it's very, very curious as to, you know, how all of a sudden this extensive outbreak of cholera just is starting to occur. And I think, as you alluded to, a lot of the people on the ground in Haiti understand this, and that's why they're resisting right now. They've been pelting, you know, the UN trucks, the MINUSTAH trucks with bottles and such, and have been protesting. A lot of people on the ground in Haiti, the everyday people, have been upset because they believe that the UN and the U.S. have brought, they're the ones that are responsible for bringing the cholera outbreak to Haiti itself today. You know, and you're right, the Western media is not going to report on that. The only place I even got a glimpse of that was Al Jazeera, you know, touched on that, where they were interviewing people on the ground, and they were saying, you know, we believe the U.N. brought this to us. The U.N. has been killing us, you know, since they invaded us years ago. We look at the UN delegation in Congo, MONUC. They've been responsible for mass rape, you know, rapings and killings there as well. So I appreciate your call. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you, bro.
All right. Take care. Peter, Any comments on that? I mean, I think that was a great call. I mean, he was right on point. I'm so glad the brother called in. But do you have any comments?
Absolutely. You know, the continuity with what's going on in Haiti today is right in line with the designs of U.S. imperialism. You know, as far back as the top of our show, you know, in the 1620s and 1630s, and it's not, and especially if we know our history, as we've been trying to bring it to light during the course of this conversation this morning. If we know that history, and we know the reality behind what motivates the European invaders and then the American imperialists if we know what motivates those people, and we know the tactics and the strategies that they've used for centuries now, then it's no surprise at all that they might use cholera in an intentional fashion to further disrupt and bring further more disunity and more just chaos to Haiti. So you know it shouldn't come as any surprise that the United States would use such disastrous and devious and devilish techniques as actually putting cholera into the water supply in Haiti. And you know, the thing is about cholera, as deadly and devastating as it is, it's very easy to treat. It's very easy to prevent, and it's very easy to treat. You know, and if the United States, you know, this powerful, wealthy, great country, right, that we're told that it is in Haiti, along with all these other nations, this UN presence, then why this disease that is so easily preventable and relatively easy to treat, why is it killing people, you know, in great numbers? It's totally unnecessary, and you know, there's definitely the U.S. and the UN both have the means to prevent this kind of outbreak of cholera, particularly because of their heavy-handed presence in Haiti. So yeah, there's no question that whether the outbreak of cholera was totally fabricated or not, it's definitely not something that the UN or the US has taken steps to eliminate. So it's definitely being used as a political tool. And the other thing too with Haiti is where we're seeing again point of continuity, going back to the Pilgrims. And what I mentioned in terms of Plymouth and why Plymouth Rock is significant, because Plymouth was the corporate underwriters for their expedition of those Pilgrims back in the 1730s, and when Glenn mentioned the role of Bill Clinton in Haiti, what is the one thing that Bill Clinton is doing in terms of his role in so-called rebuilding of Haiti? He's trying to create corporate opportunities for American corporations to go into Haiti. You know, these cruise lines and all these other entertainment venues to go in and basically just, you know, create these little pockets on the island that American corporations can exploit and take advantage of. And it's the Plymouth Rock principle all over again, or not all over again, because it never stopped. It's the continuity of the Plymouth Rock principle. It's the continuity of economic hegemony being the backbone of the kind of destruction of an entire people. But what is encouraging and what is hopeful about this is what Glenn Ford mentioned and the caller reinforced, is that Haiti has always been and will continue to be an island of resistance. And as devastated as that island is and that people has been, particularly since the earthquake, we can still look to them and learn a lot from them in terms of their resistance and their unwavering resistance to colonization and to imperialist oppression.
Right, exactly. And, very little to add. I just think it was a very sick and sadistic twist of fate, and you know, I thought it was a joke that Obama, you know, President of the United States, appointed you know, in the wake of the earthquake in Haiti, January 12th, appointed Bill Clinton and George Bush.
Right, right.
To you know, to lead, you know, U.S. efforts in so-called Haitian recovery, when those two evil bastards are the two presidents that deposed the first democratically elected leader of Haiti, John Pachana Aristide. You know, started off with Clinton in the 90s. You know, in an disposed of Aristide and only let him back in until Aristide agreed, basically forcing the hand of Aristide to agree to allow, this largely subsidized U.S. Midwestern rice to be flooded throughout the countryside, which totally, put, scores of Haitian farmers out of business, where they were using their resources from that rice and even flour to take care of their families, and it was obviously contributing to the community. And so what does that do? That forces more people into an already overpopulated Port-au-Prince. And then
right.
And then you look at the 2004 illegal coup that was orchestrated by none other than that mental midget George W. Bush,
yeah.
Where sent in his mercenaries and CIA to dispose of Harris Dean. This was a democratically elected leader, and Obama has that same filth on his hands as well. He is just as culpable, because under his administration he also does not allow John Pietrus Aristide to come back into his country. He's in exile right now in South Africa. He was initially flown out to CAR, the Central African Republic, and then the South African government took him in. But he still cannot come back to Haiti. He is still and that is by mandate by the U.S. government itself. We have 8 minutes left. I want to leave the folks with a. As you know, hip hop is very near and dear to my heart, and it tells a lot of stories, and it is resistance in its essence. I want to play this song. It's a surprise for all of you, except for some of you that are hip hop heads that have heard this song. But it's a classic. I want to play this, and it tells a story, and I'd like to just in the wake of the show that we've done on Thanksgiving, its true origins, its vile existence, and the resistance, the continued resistance of the people of Haiti. I think that this is an apropos song to play. So I want to thank everyone for listening in. Peter, if you have any, you can allow you to say goodbye yourself.
Yeah, just appreciate the opportunity to break some of this down, and I'll leave with this. I'd like folks to realize that we're not the only ones that are not in support of this fabricated holiday. So look up Unthanksgiving Day and National Day of Mourning. Unthanksgiving Day and National Day of Mourning. Look up those two things and see that there's other people out there who are in resistance to this fabrication and this lie, and pass the word on. So thanks, brother.
Right. Right on, and folks, you hit us up, message us, and we'll send you some articles as well. Be that inconvenient hero. Be willing to speak out and to educate the hoi polloi, the masses, the 85% that don't know what's going on. Be that, be that person, all right? Because if you don't, you're simply part of the problem. If you know what's going on and you choose not to say nothing and to speak out, you become part of the problem. So this is Peter, I played this song for you this summer, and I think you liked it a lot. And so here's none other than the Roscoe's with Nature of the Threat. Talk
right.
to you guys later.
Let freedom ring with a buckshot, but not just yet. First, we need to truly understand the nature of the threat. And a pale man walks in the threshold of darkness. Roughly 20,000 years ago, the first humans evolved with the phenotypical trait, genetic recessive, blue eyes, blonde hair, and white skin. Albinism apparently was a sin to the original man, African, so the mutants traveled north of the equator. Go Europeans later, the first race haters, who is the devil's alpha to the beta? Cause history best qualified to teach one, quoting German philosopher Schopenhauer, every white man is a faded or a bleached one. Migration created further mutation, genetic drifts, evolution through recombination, adapted to the climate. As the Caucasus mountain man reverted to that of a primate. Savage Neanderthals until the late Paleolithic age. That's when the black Grimaldi man came with the symbol of the dragon, fire and art. JK paintings in France and Spain to the Venus of Willendorf. Around 2000 BC, southern Russians migrate in small units. Those who travel west populated Europe. Those who went east settled in Iran, known as Aryans. 1500 BC, to cross the Khyber Pass into India and created Hinduism, the first caste system, the origins of racism. A white dot on the forehead meant to leap. The black dot to feet, untrustable, untouchable. They wrote the Holy Vedas in Sanskrit. That's the language that created Greek, German, Latin, and English. Now the Minoans around 2000 BC starts on the island of Crete in the Aegean Sea. The Greek culture begins Western civilization. But Western civilization means white domination. Mycenaeans learned from Kemet called Egypt and Greek. It existed since at least 3000 BC, creating geometry and astronomy. This knowledge influenced Plato, Socrates, and Hippocrates. Cause Imhotep, the real father of medicine, was worshipped in Greece and Rome in the form of a black African. The word Africa comes from the Greek Afrique, meaning without code. The word philosophy means love of knowledge, stole from the first man. Greek power expands, the first Greek fraternities banned. The word gymnasium is Greek for naked. This was the place where adolescent boys were educated and molested. This was accepted because Greek culture was homosexual. For example, Sophocles trained girls on the island of Lesbos, hence the word lesbian.
Hey, let these dumb motherfuckers know.
December 25th, the birth of Saturn. A homosexual god, I checked the historical pattern. December 25th, and I thought the birth of Christ was Saturnalia. When men got drunk, fucked each other, then beat their wife. Fact is, it was still practiced till they called it Christmas. So put a gerbil on your Christmas list. The Hellenistic era, Alexander the Great conquers all the way to India, leaving four successive states. By the 5th century BC, Rome succeeds to be the conqueror of Egypt and Greece, but had the threat of the black Phoenicians in Sicily. The Punic Wars began 264 BC. The black general Hannibal and Carthaginian peace. In 146 BC, Carthage fell after a 6-month siege. Rome sold every citizen in slavery, the first genocide of history. And more bisexuality in sight. Julius Caesar was known as every woman's husband and every man's wife. The Spartacus revolt, slave rebellion at North. With 6,000 slaves was nailed on a cross. Cross, hard shit, Jesus Christ. Time for the Mac right. Christians, get your facts right. Cause Christ was not his name. That's Greek for one who was anointed. Yahshua ben Yosef was his name. Do Christians know this? So who do you praise? Do you know his name? Or do you do this in vain? Accepting the religion they gave slaves to behave. Peep the description of a story in Josephus. Short, dark, with an underdeveloped beard was Jesus. He had the Roman spirit in revolution. The solution was to take him to court and falsely accuse him. After being murdered by Pilate, how can it be these same white Romans established Christianity? Constantine would later see the cross in a dream. In his vision, it read, in hoc signa wonka, in this night we conquer, manifest destiny. In 325, he convened the Nicene Creed and separated God into three. Decided Jesus was born on December 25th and raising on the third day is a myth, plus to deceivers. Commissioned Michelangelo to paint white pictures of Jesus. He used his aunt, uncle, and nephew. Subconsciously, that affects you. It makes you put white people closer to God.
Yo, the man got game like a motherfucker.
True indeed, fuck it, jihad. In the 8th century, Muslims conquered Spain, Portugal, and France and controlled it for 700 years. They never mention this in history class, because those faiths are threatened when you get the real lesson. Moors from Baghdad, Turkey. Threaten European Christians, meaning the white way of life. Hence the crusade for Christ. On November 25th, 1491, Santiago defeats the last Muslim stronghold, Granada. King Ferdinand gave thanks to God for victory, and the Pope of Rome declared this day to forever be a day of thanksgiving for all European Christians. Now listen, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, what you are actually celebrating is the proclamation of the Pope of Rome, who later in league with Queen Isabella sent Cardinal Zimino to Spain to murder any black that was anti-Christianity. These Moors, these black men and women, were from Baghdad, Turkey. And today you eat the turkey for your Thanksgiving day as the European power destroyed the turkey who was a poor father.
Get on the ground!
Get on
the ground!
Let's fight the power.
Get on the ground!
Bitch ass nigga.
Get down!
Now around this time, whites started calling us Negroes. That's Spanish for black object, meaning we're not really people but property. And the triangle trade begins, they seize us. Queen Elizabeth sent the first slaves on a ship named Jesus. Stealing land from the indigenous natives. Gave them alcohol to keep the red man intoxicated. Whites claimed they had to civilize these pagan animals. But up until 1848, there's documented cases of whites being the savage cannibals. Eating Indians. In 1992, it was Jeffrey Dahmer. They slaughtered a whole race with guns, drugs, priests, and nuns. 1763, the first demonic tactic of biological warfare. As tokens of peace, Sir Jeffrey Amherst passed out clothing and blankets to the Indian community. Infested with smallpox, knowing they had no immunity. Today it's age, you best believe it's man-made. His ain't a damn thing changed. Let me explain, I sense people of color are genetically dominant, and Caucasoids are genetically recessive, and whites expect to be predominant, meaning survive as a race, and they simply must take precautions. That's why they're worried about the future now, cause by 2050 almost all the Earth's population will be browned and black, so understanding that, whites counter-react.
I'm saying, man, the fools ain't nothing but a teaspoon of milk in a world color majority.
So they created a system to force blacks into an unnatural position that reinforces the position of natural inferiority. In addition, created guns and developed the ethnocentric view that God justifies every fucking thing they do. Condition people to perceive white culture as civilized and every other culture considered primitive. Not true. Racism is the system of racial subjugation against non-whites in every area of the human relation. Entertainment, education, labor, politics, law, religion, sex, war, and economics. See, blacks were three-fifths of a man with tax purposes intended. You think you're Afro-American, you're a 14th Amendment and a good nigga. Jews don't salute the fucking swastika, but niggas pledge allegiance to the flag that accosted you. They never teach about the breaker islands like Jamaica. But before slaves came here, whites would take her. Pregnant woman hang her from a tree by her toes. Slice her stomach with a knife and let the unborn baby fall to the floor. They stop an unborn child in front of all the slaves. To end breed fear so they be scared, behave, and not rebel, move. Understand, all whites must be perceived as potential predators. I paraphrase historian Ishaka Musa Barashenko. Understand that regardless of the lofty ideas engraved on paper, in such documents as the Constitution, a Declaration, the basic nature of the European-American white man remains virtually unchanged. So check. This is the nature of the threat.